interpreted thusly and whatever, and at least there'll be some sort of, then you can go from there. What do you think? I mean, I'm just suggesting.
About thought.
You mean where we went from?
Yeah.
Enough to do a lot. You know, I even could use the word revolutionary. Oh, well, that's wonderful.
All right, we were everything okay?
Everything's okay. 10 seconds.
Okay. We'll just wait for all the other conversations to... So I guess the best way to begin is to say that I know we're old friends, and old friends don't usually sit with one of them having notes on his lap to have a conversation, but this is a special occasion. I want to thank you for sitting down here this way. And so I hope you'll forgive the impropriety if I read from some of these notes.
It's all right.
I have prepared some questions.
Yes.
The first question is... some people might find it unusual for a theoretical physicist to have an interest in things like consciousness and the thinking process. But in fact, your work reflects a growing involvement with these and associated subjects over a period of many years. When did this interest begin? How and why has it become such an important aspect of your present work? And can what you now explore still be considered physics, theoretical or otherwise?
Yes, well, I think implicitly my interest in consciousness began very early, but the earliest incident that I can recall happened about at the age of 11 or 12, I can't remember, but I was with some boys and we were in the mountains near Wilkes-Barre, crossing a rather rapidly flowing stream, and
That's in Pennsylvania. In the States.
That's right. And there were a lot of rocks we had to cross on. They were rather far apart and very small, and you couldn't just step across them, and I felt very apprehensive. It seemed a new situation. But I suddenly realized you had to jump from one to the other without stopping in between, that you were in a state of movement, pivoting on one rock while you moved to the next. Whereas I'd usually thought of going from one step to another, and I was mapping out the steps.
And generally you were, that's the way you functioned up until
yes,
that point?
Yes, well, I think people generally did, a lot of them.
Mm-hmm. In other words, you think before you...
Well, you try to map it out a bit, and it's more secure and so on. But, see, here was a case that wouldn't work, and you had to do it from moment to moment. Then after that, I felt that it made a deep impression on me that this theme has recurred a lot in my work. You know, that your consciousness is going moment by moment of awareness, and not mapped out.
Do you recall that coming back again later, before you even went into physics?
Well, I can't remember. You know, I don't really recall a lot of my childhood.
I see.
But I think this was combined with some tendency to feel, want to go beyond limits. You see, when I was in this small town, city of Wilkes-Barre, you see, the nearest towns around it were called Ashley, Sugar Notch, and Warrior Run. So that's all I knew. I mean, I didn't know them, but I knew about them. So then we went for a ride beyond Warrior Run. It seemed like going beyond the world, you see.
I see.
And so I had this notion of, see, people talked about the world, and I said, where does it end? And,
what answer did they give you?
Well, I don't remember. It wasn't terribly convincing, I suppose. I think that notion used to fascinate me. I remember in third grade, perhaps, there was a sort of a Nordic folk tale of about some place which was east of the sun and west of the moon. The idea being that it was beyond all limits. And that idea always fascinated me. I think that was combined. You see that I didn't really want to stay within limits, you see. And this was combined with my interest in consciousness, which was mostly implicit at that time. I mean, I sure didn't very often think about it explicitly.
Mm-hmm. And what period of time was that in
what?
Chronologically, it was about the 20s or the 30s?
It was in the 20s, yeah.
The 20s. So the Depression hadn't yet?
No, it hadn't come yet.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall the Depression years?
Oh, yes. Well, yes, I recall them, you know, that there was a great deal of unemployment and suffering, and people were out of jobs, and banks were failing.
And you were in a coal mining area.
In a coal mining area there, and people were talking about things getting very bad, you know, even revolution.
Really?
And then Roosevelt came in, and he produced all these new measures which gave people hope, you see. And I think they lifted things up a little bit and gave people some hope that at least it would get better. But I was I became very interested in politics because I thought, you know, we've got to do something about this sort of thing, you think? Mm-hmm. As well as about the growing danger of war, you know, with people like Mussolini and Hitler.
Hmm. And still your interest in science was developing along,
yes,
along
it was,
with that?
Yes, it was. And I became, you know, I became interested. I used to go to the public library with a friend of mine. We'd get books on chemistry and physics and so mm-hmm. on, and studied them. I read the Scientific American about atomic power. Mm-hmm. I read science fiction. The idea of atomic power fascinated me. I thought that would be a solution, I mean, unlimited energy. But anyway, your question was originally how I got into consciousness.
Right. Right.
So, I think that I remember in college once raising myself the question, are we totally determined or are we free, you see? And is our consciousness free or is it determined like a machine? But at that time I concluded it didn't matter as long as we at least could feel free to do what we wanted.
I see.
But later, I think... you see, when we came to study quantum mechanics, when I was at Berkeley in California with Oppenheimer, mm-hmm. There were friends there who were very interested in Niels Bohr. Now, Niels Bohr had called attention to an analogy between thought and quantum mechanics, that in quantum mechanics, whenever you observe something, you change it in an unpredictable and uncontrollable way. You can't analyze it. Now, if you try to look at your thought process, it changes too. That is, if you try to define your thought, it becomes unclear where it's going. If it's going somewhere, then you're sort of in momentum, then you don't define it. This was very similar to the behavior of the electron in quantum theory. Mm-hmm. So I felt there might be some connection between consciousness and physics there.
Later on, when you wrote your book on quantum theory, you actually did introduce
Yes,
that.
I brought that idea up, yes.
And that was in 1952?
1951, yes.
51.
Well, it was published in...
And then in the book that followed it, Causality and Change...
Chance.
And Chance in Modern Physics, were there elements of that, of consciousness?
Well, mostly implicit. There I had the idea of this infinity of the universe, not merely quantitative, but qualitative, infinity of levels of chance and necessity, to say that we look for laws that are necessary, like the Newton's laws, and then we discover there are limits to them. These limits are due necessity is what cannot be otherwise, and the limits are due to contingencies, what can be otherwise, that the thing is bound to depend on something else.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, if you have a feather floating in the wind, if the feather floated in a vacuum, were in a vacuum, it would fall. In the air, it's supported, and the slightest breeze will shift it this way and that way. See, it can be otherwise. In the vacuum, it falls necessarily. Mm. So by connecting with the broader context, you get contingency, and if these are very complicated and chaotic, you get chance, right, where you can't predict at all.
Right. Now, I know you connected those thoughts later on more specifically with respect to thought, but following the line of the development of consciousness, you went from writing that book to the theory Yeah. The special relativity book, if I remember.
Yes. You see, the point about the causality book was that it brought up this potentially unlimited nature of reality, which would include consciousness, so it had something to do with that. The idea being that consciousness would have no specifiable limits. Along with nature, I thought nature and consciousness were not only reflecting each other, but actually participating in each other.
Now, was that considered a unique perception at that time?
Well, I don't know how people considered it.
I was wondering if you got any sort of response from
Well, I got some favorable reviews of the book, but I mean, they didn't really, that wasn't one of the main points stressed there.
Now, in the book that followed, I know there was an appendix to the special relativity.
Yes, that was in the 60s, and I wrote a book on special relativity with an appendix which I devoted to perception, and I said that there was an analogy between perception and the way relativity treated things, that you couldn't, according to relativity, everything was related to the way that you interacted with it to observe it, you see, and also according to quantum mechanics. Right? Now, see, the point about perception is that it's a dynamic process, that we are constantly doing things and then seeing what happens, right? Handling objects and seeing what happens, or move. Everything must move. The eyeball must move in order to show light, to show form. And it's an active process. Right? Now, suppose we say we are looking at a circular object, solid, and as we walk around it, it really looks like an ellipse. You know, an artist draws it that way, with perspective. But we know by now that there are different appearances of the circle. We say, really, it's a circle, which is solid, right?
Yeah.
So we could say the ellipse is their appearance, and the circle is the essence, right? But then scientists came along and said that's only an appearance, too, because the circle is made of a lot of atoms. It's really mostly empty space, atoms moving there. And therefore, the atoms are the essence. So, but then others, later on, they came along and said these atoms are made of smaller objects, they're mostly empty space. Atoms, too, are appearances. And then these smaller objects were found to be made of quarks and so on. There were electrons and protons, then made of quarks, and then they said these are fields. And see, they're looking for a theory of everything, but it keeps on receding, right? In other words, so I say that this suggests to me that everything is, even our thoughts are fundamentally appearances, how things appear to the mind, right? And we combine, by combining many views of the object, we understand the object, say in the stereoscope, two views give three dimensions. Is that clear?
Yeah.
So by combining many views of the circle, of this object, we get the notion it's a circle. By combining it with the scientific view, we get another view on it. A circle which is made of atoms, but then another view is that the atoms are constituted of smaller particles and so on. The more views we get that we can integrate and make coherent, the deeper our understanding of the reality is, right? But I say the reality, the essence would be called the true being, that really we never get hold of, right? It's unlimited. Everything, every view is limited. It's like a mirror looking this way, another, many, many mirrors. Each one gives a view, a limited view, right? But see, so I said theories don't give final true knowledge. They give a way of looking. The very word theoria in Greek means theater, same word. It's sort of a theater of the mind that gives insight into the thing, right? And therefore, you can say that fundamentally science is involved in a perceptual enterprise, not primarily in gaining knowledge, though knowledge appears, but knowledge is a byproduct. And by understanding the thing, you can coherently, then our contact with it, as long as it is coherent, it shows that our understanding is correct. You see, we must distinguish between correct appearances and incorrect appearances or illusory, right? Now, if an appearance is correct, it is in some way related to the reality, but it's evidently not the reality. The ellipses, if we understand their meaning, are a correct appearance to the eye. Though it's not an ellipse, it's still correct.
So So are you suggesting that this is an inherent aspect of the thinking process?
Yes, that's right, and of our whole perceptual process. Mm-hmm. Our thinking process should be called an extension of our perception when done rightly.
I see, of course.
Mm-hmm. Not primarily the accumulation of knowledge, which we put into various records.
Well, that's a rather profound statement. Could you repeat that again?
Our thinking process, I would perhaps now make a distinction between thinking and thought. Thinking is an active verb, thinking. It means you're doing something.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing you're doing is criticizing your thoughts, or seeing whether they cohere. And if they don't, you begin to change them and experiment with others. You get new intuitions and new insights. And thought is the past participle. It's what has been done.
Yeah.
It goes on the record, somewhat like a computer program, but that's not a very good analogy. I call it conditioning. You see, if we take Pavlov and his dogs, he had dogs who would salivate when they saw food. Now, he rang a bell associated with the food, and sooner or later they began to salivate just by the bell. So there's an elementary thought there, which was whenever a bell rings, see, the first reflex was whenever food is there, salivation occurs, right? That may have been built in mm-hmm. instinctively. The second reaction, which is conditioned, is whenever the bell rings, salivation must occur. It didn't have to go through this step of saying this means the same as seeing the object, right?
Hmm.
Now, I think that's a kind of elementary thought, you see, that every thought is active in that way.
Hmm.
So if you say, whenever this happens, I need to do this. Whenever X happens, I need to do Y. Now, that you don't have to think. But immediately when X happens, you're already doing Y, right? It's a reflex. Now, that is the nature of thought. And one reflex leads to another. But you say, whenever I think this, I must conclude that. Whenever I conclude that, I must go to the next step. You see, it may be established by association or by other ways, like reasoning.
Hmm.
We try to organize it logically. Or by similarities, association in time is the simplest. Similarities and association by similarity, or connection by logic. But once it's done, it's all the same. It's a reflex. See, logic is a reflex.
So it becomes a learned...
And it has to be criticized by watching for its coherence. A logical argument, when it looks very logical, it's not always so.
Hmm.
It's often incoherent. You have to be sensitive to that. It's a perceptive process.
Hmm. Hmm. And how much of that, of what we've just discussed or I have listened to, was touched upon going back to the special relativity?
Yeah, it was rather implicit. Quite a bit of it was touched upon.
You had mentioned the Piaget work.
The work of Piaget, in which we say that the child is always learning
mm-hmm.
and seeing. He makes an action outward toward the object and handles it, and he gets a perception. Now, if the perception does not cohere with the intention of the action, he's got to change the action. He's constantly learning, right?
And you really mean cohere.
I mean hold together in a coherent way so mm-hmm. that if he expects a certain result and doesn't get it, it shows he didn't understand, right?
Right.
So he's got to change his idea, his intention.
Mm-hmm.
So learning is the constant sensitivity to not getting the intended result and changing the intention so that you get the intended result, right?
I see. And that's a learning process.
That's a learning. And I say that happens not only in perception of the young child, it learns with the animal, but all the highest and most abstract logical thought is exactly the same.
It's based on the same sequence.
Yeah.
And it is sequential almost.
Yeah.
It? Yeah.
Mm. And you see, this learning is a process, right?
Hmm.
And it all depends. If we base it entirely on memory, on thought, and what has been done, then there's no reason it should work. You see? It will go wrong. I mean, whenever anything changes,
right.
And things are always changing.
Hmm.
So you need an awareness, a sensitivity to incoherence going beyond that. See, this is all with the nature of thought, you can see.
This aspect of coherence and incoherence is really at the core of it all.
Yes. Without coherence, our actions are counterproductive and lead to... You know, at least they lead us to what we don't want. They can lead us to all sorts of tragedy and suffering.
I'd like to hold that thought and come back to it, because I know you speak in terms of a coherent culture, which is something which appears to be lacking at the present time. But I'd like to just complete the original question, which was following your line in your work in physics.
Mm-hmm.
After the relativity book came the book Wholeness.
Wholeness and the Implicate Order, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, that was a further development. Now, I should say, to understand that, we should mention, go back to your first question about why I'm interested in consciousness. Now, I began to go into philosophy, you know, in the late 40s,
mm-hmm.
more interested in what is causality and so on. I became interested in more general questions. And some of these people in Berkeley had been interested in dialectical materialism. It seemed to have some valuable points, namely that they considered everything in its constant change and interrelationship rather than static, which was close to the view I wanted.
It was also sort of an attempt to fuse religion and, I mean, science and
yeah, they tried to bring in science and so on. Now, I went to Brazil for a number of years where I met a man called Mario Schoenberg, who was also interested in Marxism, and he advised me to, he said I should read Hegel, who was really the source of a lot of Marx's ideas. And when I got to Israel, I read Hegel's Logic, and there I found something very interesting that, well, we all know that he was saying, watch thought as a process. In other words, it was really going along with my interests, you see.
In other words, don't be that concerned with its content?
Yes, yes. You see, even when I was crossing the stream, I was really thinking of the process, you see, right? Not only the process of the body, but the process of implicitly the process of thought, which was trapping me in the old way, right?
Of course.
So it was because I thought in a certain way that I found the stream difficult. As soon as I had to have a sudden shift of thinking, and then I crossed the stream quite easily, right? So and that was thinking, right? Not thought. That was an
okay.
That was very fast, you see, in one fraction of a second. It was a perception.
And then an action.
But it was a perception at the level of thought, and saying, you know, you have to move. There's cases, you can't map it all out. Here's a case where you have to be in movement,
mm-hmm.
and from moment to moment. Right?
Mm.
And I only put that in words later.
Sure.
So, where were we now then?
With Hegel.
Yes, with Hegel. Well, he says thought is a process. You've got to, and one key thing he said, pay attention to thought, you see, as you would to anything else.
Hmm.
Now, I think people don't do that. They say thought just goes where it will. It seems to be something beyond attention. It just happens. what can you pay attention to? You see, you have to pay attention to the order of the process.
To the order
of the process. Now, Hegel did that in the sense he paid attention to the order of development of concepts through what he called, you know, to posit the concept, you know, the thesis, and then the negation of it, the antithesis. Mm-hmm. And then he said, these sort of nullify each other, and a new concept emerges, a synthesis, however, which contains the old ones as insubstantial forms, you see.
Was that a limited attempt at following? Because he was limiting himself.
He was limiting himself to a very small part of thought, but still it was something.
The process was still perceived as a process.
Yeah, so he took thought as a process, which I think is a very radically different way from most people, mm-hmm. most philosophers. And I don't know whether Marx did or not take thought as a process. He applied it to society, and implicitly he was doing it, but those who followed Marx in communism probably missed the point altogether.
Sure.
The insight was very much clearer in Hegel in spite of his rather difficult language.
mm-hmm.
So, we'll come back to the early 60s. You see, in the late 50s and early 60s, I was getting a bit uneasy about science, where it was going, you see.
Where was it going?
Well, I felt physics in particular was moving in the direction of just simply wanting to calculate results, you see, and have equations and calculate results, saying there was no way to understand anything at all. That came out of what Bohr was saying, that...
Mm-hmm.
there were, like if you have an interference experiment, see, you have two slits and a beam of electrons comes in, is detected at a screen. Now, there's what's called an interference pattern, that you get a statistical pattern of detection of electrons. Now, if one slit is open, you get a certain pattern. If two are open, you get another one.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the point is that in certain points, when two slits are open, the pattern has zero intensity. It's canceled at certain places and increased at others and produces what's called fringes. And if these were waves, you could understand it by saying the waves from one slit cancel the other at
right.
those places. But you always see electrons coming in as particles and they go out as particles, so why should they be waves? And you would think they have to turn into a wave in between.
Mm-hmm.
But what Bohr said was no, that was beyond any possible ability of description or conception. It just happened, and you could only calculate statistically what the results would be according to the quantum algorithm, as he called it.
And that adhered as a means of...
Yes, now that most people didn't really understand Bohr's subtlety, but that view was developing anyway, and they said physics is primarily concerned with getting equations and calculating experimental results. Right?
And didn't that sort of fit in with the psychological period, the time when results were important,
it was yeah.
post-war? And
well, it was probably the whole culture had been building up to it, but
yeah.
The idea of understanding this thing, well, they didn't see the point. You see, they said that, what more do you want? Mm.
So there was no attempt to understand what was going on. It was just the results
yeah.
were what were
they
important.
Thought this was all you could do, and what more could anybody want anyway?
Okay, right. We're getting results.
Mm. Yeah, so, well, I was unhappy with that, and I tried to talk another way in physics. I was developing a kind of a general cosmology which I could understand, but most physicists didn't see the point. You see, that I gave some talks and they said, "What? Wonder what you're doing." You see, is this the kind of mathematics? Or, you know, they couldn't see why I was doing it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not that they were badly disposed toward me or anything, but they were just puzzled. So, So I began to feel rather, wonder what, you know, there were many times when I felt that I wonder if I should go on with this, you see, with physics.
By that time, of course, you had worked with Einstein. Had he been supportive of
Well, I didn't work with him. I had many discussions with him. We had correspondence.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he supported the idea of, that we should look for some sort of reality, which we're talking about, and not just have this...
I see.
These calculations, right?
I see. Yeah. So it was just you and him?
So,
in fact, there really was a dichotomy, though. There was, most people just ignored that aspect of it.
Yeah, well, they thought that there were apparently proofs by a physicist called von Neumann that this would be impossible and so on.
Hmm.
And you see, in 1951, I developed another interpretation where it was possible to look at it as real. Where I said the electron was both a wave and a particle.
Mm-hmm.
So when it went through the slits, the wave went through both slits, the electron went through one, but the wave would influence the particle afterward, so it would determine where it could arrive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a typical example, but it would work out, but people didn't want to consider it because they said unless it gave new results, they wouldn't think of it, you see. So I didn't think of the argument then, but the idea I proposed had, in fact, been proposed by de Broglie in 1927, and I didn't know about it then. I knew later. And he proposed it, and it was discussed at the Solvay Congress in 1927, where all the leading physicists were, Einstein and Bohr and Pauli and others, and they all jumped on it. See, Einstein didn't like it because he thought it was too simple and cheap. He didn't think it would fit relativity. And the others just simply... didn't like it, and because they had different ideas of their own, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they even made fun of it, and I can't remember the terms, but and then de Broglie got discouraged and gave it up. But see, I wrote this paper, and after that, de Broglie took it up again. But in this paper, I answered those objections that they made and developed the thing further. Right?
I see.
Now, but on the whole, it fell on the rest of the physics community like a thud on lead, you see, like dropping a ball on.
It appears that it has been revitalized, that perception,
well,
in recent times.
Well, I've been continuing recently to develop it, and now writing a book on it with my colleague Basil Hiley, and we're getting more interest from some of the philosophers of science, and I don't know, some physicists.
Mm.
and I think maybe it will increase.
I see. So we digress to get to that point, to go back to the 60s, and we're still following the line. We're on the, we were on the wholeness and the implicate order.
Yeah, but I mean, this is part of it,
of course,
to say the...
Leading up to it.
Now, you see, then I went... at that point, I got in touch with this man, Krishnamurti. There, in the public library, there was a book, and in that book, there was a phrase, you know, the observer and the observed, you see, and I thought this fellow would... was on the same line as I.
Could we pause there for a moment now, because that's a giant leap for some of us. As I understand it, the observer and the observed had been introduced as a perception by Werner Heisenberg.
Bohr first,
and then
Heisenberg,
taken up by.
Both about the same time in different ways, and.
So it was
was my interest, the oneness of the observer and the observed, which was due, according to them, to the indivisible quantum link between observer and observed.
Really?
Okay. And this was partly responsible for the analogy between thought and quantum process, which I mentioned before.
Right.
You got it?
Right. So you were in the library one afternoon.
Well, my wife was in there, and she found the book and saw the phrase. She always objects to my bringing it up. But anyway, I read the book very avidly, and I said, okay, I must talk with this man. And he hadn't been, I wrote to the publisher, and apparently he'd been ill for a while, but he was coming to England and to talk. And
what year was this?
1961.
61.
Mm-hmm. And... I met him in London, and we had a very, you know, he didn't know any physics, but still he listened to me talk about it. It was a very great interest. And
so it was a warm attraction to each other from the very beginning.
Yeah, we sort of had an instant communication.
Mm-hmm.
And you may ask, you know, why was I interested in a man like Krishnamurti? You would think people might have thought of him as a mystic. Well, I was getting interested in all sorts of broader philosophy then. And I had the notion that I think part of my whole cosmology was that the mind and matter were interconnected, two sides of one thing. And therefore, that we not only had connection to the world through the senses, but in some deeper level.
Of course.
And I thought maybe somebody like Krishnamurti, with all the perceptions that he had, which I could read about, would perhaps have been in that, had that possibility.
And those perceptions are manifested in everyday life. He was trying to explain those.
Well, but he sort of perceived. It seemed to me he sort of perceived directly some sort of wholeness, this wholeness of the, mm-hmm. the universe and the observer and the observed and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So. I didn't know quite what it meant, but it sort of looked as if it would be important.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember that I always felt I would like to get beyond all limits. I mean, I didn't want to stay within the limits of physics as physicists had defined it.
Really?
I was already getting to the point where I said I couldn't stay there any longer. And
In fact, you had even thought about leaving physics.
Yes, well, even in... Even in the early 50s, you know, late 40s rather, just after the war, that attitude became prevalent. I was thinking of it, but I didn't actually leave physics. But anyway, I did follow this thing up with Krishnamurti, and we met every year when he came to London, and later I went to Switzerland where he gave talks, and later he established a school in near London, and. I used to take part in that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we had many discussions, you see. Now, partly through these discussions, although not entirely, I came to this idea of the implicate order. At least it greatly encouraged me in that direction. I may have had the idea before in a very germ form, but...
Could we pause there for a moment again? The term implicate...
Yeah.
It seems to be connected to the word imply.
And enfold, yes. The word implicate is the same root as imply. It means enfold.
Enfold.
In Latin, and explicate to unfold, and explicit.
Explicit.
Yeah, so if you say one thought implies another, it means that the thought is enfolded, right?
Mm-hmm. unfolds. In other words, if I'm speaking of something, it may imply something else.
Yeah, but that's already unfolded in your mind.
Right.
And it comes out and becomes explicit. Now, the idea was that you can think, say, of a piece of paper which you fold up many times and you make little cuts in it. When you unfold it, a whole pattern appears, right?
Right.
Many other ideas and examples could come to mind, but I haven't time, really.
Right, but essentially you're saying that would be the unfolded part would be
when it's all together and
then
it unfolds. But then there's a reverse process of unfolding.
Unfolding again.
Mm-hmm. Now, I saw that you could understand the quantum mechanics in terms of that process, that instead of saying an electron, for example, is a particle just moving along, you could think that there's a wave coming in, unfolding. Mm-hmm. Or it's really unfolding to a point. It's unfolded in the whole universe. Then it folds back. Then another wave comes in a slightly different point. You get a series of points that are very close together, so we imagine they're a particle.
Mm-hmm.
But because of that wave nature from which it comes, you understand the wave-particle nature.
Mm-hmm.
That is, it's a wave. You understand that.
And because we're used to seeing things in movement on this macro level,
yeah,
the assumption has been that that's the way the electron...
Yeah. Yes, we've been extrapolating. And then when you found the way the macro level works, and when you found in quantum mechanics it didn't make sense, you said there's nothing more to do except calculate.
Mm-hmm. Could we, again, the term quantum itself has its base in that?
Well, the quantum, that's one of the features of quantum theory. Quantum has its base in the fact that energy is transferred in discrete jumps, or quanta.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than continuously.
I see.
Now, you can see that some sort of quantum appears here, that the wave comes to a point, then there's a jump to another point.
Mm-hmm.
See, one thing, according to quantum theory, was the electron could go from one state to another without passing in between. Now, you said that is utter mystery, right?
Right.
But you see, if the wave comes into this point, then it spreads out, it could come into another point.
Into another one.
You see, so therefore it needn't look so mysterious.
Is it possible to state that that's the way thought, the thinking process?
Yes, we could anticipate by saying that's how the thinking process goes. It goes in, it unfolds, it's unfolded in your consciousness, it unfolds to a certain thought, folds back, and the next thought appears different. A series of thoughts not too different seem to be continuous. Right?
And is that where the now popular term quantum leap has its origins, actually?
Well, those jumps. Yes, they take the idea of a jump that doesn't pass in between.
Mm-hmm. So there's no way of knowing how it gets from point A to point B in on a macro level.
No, that jump is creative, you see.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, from the explanation I gave.
Surely.
You see, to say the quantum jump or quantum leap is a creative process.
Mm-hmm. And you're suggesting that in the implicate order that it manifests in another place as opposed to traveling from point A to point B.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was the basic line of reasoning in the wholeness and the implicate order work.
And which connected consciousness with matter because they had a parallel process, right?
In other words, at that basic implicate level,
all existence, all being.
All being was
in one order. I call it the implicate order because it's the order of unfoldment that counts, not the order of movement on a line.
So that the greater, the action itself really takes place in the implicate.
Yes.
And the
it manifests in the explicate.
And it manifests in the explicate.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But it's part of the same tradition of science saying that what we thought was the essence is now the appearance.
Say that again. What we thought was the essence
is now seen to be another appearance, right? Namely, that the particle which was explaining everything as the essence of reality.
Is appearance.
Is also an appearance.
Is also, in addition to its being essence.
No, everything is both essence and appearance in that sense. But all appearances are essential.
Or else we wouldn't.
Yeah,
be able to see them.
They're all appearances, and the essence as the true being is unknown, right?
Uh-huh.
Even the implicate order is merely a concept.
Surely.
So even that should turn out to be an appearance. But we say by bringing in deeper, more penetrating appearances, we understand better. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
We're never going to grasp the whole.
Mm-hmm. And that has its own implications in understanding the world as we perceive it.
Yes. Yes, it was. See, this is against the view which some a large number of physicists are coming out saying we're going to get a theory of everything, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the 19th century, after Newton had been so successful for several centuries, one of the leading physicists of the time, Lord Kelvin, said, it's no use for young people to go into physics. It's nearly finished. It's only a matter of the next decimal point being nearly finished. It's only a matter of the next decimal point being nearly finished. It's only a matter of the next decimal point being refined. Try something else. So he said there are two small clouds on the horizon, the negative results of the Michelson-Morley experiment and the problems of black body radiation. These were the right clouds because each one of these led to a revolution, one to relativity, the other to quantum.
They were the wrong ones for Kelvin, unfortunately.
Well, he chose his clouds very well, but he thought they were small clouds, you
uh-huh.
see.
And in fact, the revolution
came out of them. Now, we still have much bigger clouds on the horizon today.
At the present time, as a result of...
No, but physics has developed onward into all sorts of new things.
And mm-hmm.
a lot of things are not understood today, more serious than that was then, but people still talk of the theory of everything. They live in hope, you see.
I see. And this theory of everything, is it somehow tied into the... tie into the unified theory that Einstein was...
Well, that would be it, to try a realization of Einstein.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's no harm in having a unified theory, but just don't say it covers everything, because it will be also an appearance.
And essentially, you're saying that all theories are that. They are a way of looking at things as opposed
that's
to
right, yes.
an absolute
yes,
truth.
It will be an appearance. You see, we'll have it will be an appearance which reflects, in principle, everything. You see, the whole, rather. Mm-hmm. See, we have all sorts of mirrors by which we can see different things. So this will be an appearance of a whole,
mm-hmm.
which may even include ourselves. You see, in other words, we see ourselves in this mirror, too.
Okay. Can I make a quantum leap and suggest that because, if such is the case, then to take our thinking process as absolute is a mistake?
Yes. Yes, just from
scientific... And the results of the thinking process as well.
Yes, now just from scientific point of view alone, it's a mistake. But it's a mistake, if you look directly at the process, you could see how serious that mistake is.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And so now, at the present time, you find that your work on the unconsciousness is, in fact, parallel to the other work you're doing and in fact, possibly paramount. The
yes.
book that you're bringing out... Mr. Hiley.
Well, that's on quantum theory. That's really an attempt to bring out some of the stuff I did 30 years ago, or 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm. But it has to do with an approach other than Bohr's approach.
Yes, that's right.
Could you explain the difference between the two approaches?
Well, Bohr's approach is to say nothing can be said about it at all, but just to calculate, right?
I see.
Now, this attempts to give a concept of it, right?
Yes, a concept.
Another appearance, let's call it.
Another appearance. But it's heavily leaning toward meaning, as I understand.
Yes. Well, it gives more meaning in the sense that if we have the implicate order and so on with the consciousness in a similar order, we have a creative order which has more meaning, you see. See, in this mechanical order, it would be very hard to get much meaning,
mm-hmm.
or in the order of just calculating things.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, as Steven Weinberg has said, one of the leading theoretical physicists of the time, that the more they look more into the cosmos, the less they see meaning, you see. And, but that's inevitable if you say, anyway, you're just calculating, you see.
I see. And do you think that perception is permeating our society?
Well, it has an effect because ultimately society is highly affected by science as it once was by religion, which now has no longer the source of our worldview.
Mm-hmm.
Science is the source of the worldview that religion used to give. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the view of totality has great power, mm-hmm. because the view of totality in principle has supreme value. You see that? See, God, what would he be? He made everything, so he has the highest possible value.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the universe, which has the highest possible value, is meaningless, then there's not what else can have value.
But in fact, in pursuing your avenue of inquiry, it is essentially attempting to bring meaning back into life.
Well, we'll say that there's no reason to do what they're doing. That's the first point.
Yes, yeah.
And the universe isn't what they say it is, so there's room
so
in it for all sorts of unlimited meaning, you see.
Mm-hmm.
If you say the universe is even in matter, it is creative, then much more so in mind.
I see. Are there aspects of consciousness in the new book that's coming out? Are they touching?
Well, we have that last chapter. We'll discuss consciousness.
You will?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, that brings us up to date with respect to the line that you followed.
Yes.
from the beginning. My next question is, in fact, connected with it. You've likened your own perception of how we comprehend reality to Plato's allegory of the cave. Could we explore that element a bit?
Well, in Plato's allegory of the cave, the people were chained and looking at the shadows on the cave and trying to see regularity in the shadows. You could imagine them doing calculations, saying that there's a certain probability that this shadow would become that shadow and so on. Mm-hmm. Now, Plato suggested that if they were able to turn around and look at the light, well, first of all, they would be blinded, but eventually they would see that these shadows were only shadows.
Right? Mm-hmm.
Well, I would say that in some sense, it's whatever we see is a kind of shadow. It's an appearance, but to understand that they are shadows and that we can get more and more appearances is crucial, right?
And get lost in the shadows.
Well, if we take the shadows to be the reality, you see, the essential point is to see the shadows are not the reality, but they still may throw light. You can't say a shadow throws light, but you say they may still be relevant to reality.
Relevant.
If you understand what they are.
Mm-hmm.
The shadow gives you...
Oh, if you understand it as a shadow as opposed to the ultimate reality.
The shadow gives you information about reality, right?
Of course, yeah. And with respect to the light itself?
Well, the light would be the unknown light. You see, if we take it to be consciousness, the light is a kind of intelligence which is in the deeper even than the implicate order. It's enfolded and beyond, right?
So the implicate order has other orders
beyond it, yes. Well, the higher order implicate orders, but eventually it sort of goes off to a horizon which we can't grasp.
Mm-hmm.
We say that's the source of the light of intelligence, right?
I see, and that would be what in the past has been known as the unknowable or the ineffable?
Yes, the ineffable and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And
so this would be a scientific pointing to the ineffable.
Yes.
Well, that's a revelation in itself, I would think.
Yes, and we'd say that light is needed to be thrown on thought.
Mm-hmm.
If it isn't, thought is a bunch of shadows which will be taken for realities.
Mm. And you can really prettify those shadows so that they become totally mesmerizing. And
yeah.
And we are lost in that as the real reality.
Yeah.
Mm. Following that the allegorical train, I know that not long ago I once heard you describe a scenario for a science fiction movie that is essentially an artistic metaphor for our present state of consciousness. You remember the story?
Yes. Yes, well, it was a story about very advanced beings from some distant galaxy journeying through space, and their way of exploring was to send very highly developed robots to explore the planets, right?
Mm-hmm.
Each robot had an onboard computer to deal with local problems, but ultimately there was a central computer that behind it all, right?
Right.
For all the robots. And you see, these robots came to a certain planet and they started exploring, and they went into a very deep cave and lost contact with the central computer. And they began to think independently. And they got rather confused, and they began to think that they were independent robots or independent beings.
Right.
And then they came out, they started, each one was independent, so they all started to fight each other.
Mm-hmm.
And they did all sorts of things to each other. And the beings at the center didn't know what to do. You see, the central computer, there was no way to force the robots to do anything.
Uh-huh.
Only information could work, right?
Right.
So they were already rejecting the information from the central computer, saying it doesn't exist, you see, because
mm-hmm.
we're independent, right? So therefore,
So in fact, that information that was being transmitted was real information,
yeah.
Which would imply that force or power could not be used.
That's
otherwise,
right.
It would not be.
It would
true
make
information.
No sense. Yeah.
Right.
Therefore, from the central ship came. They sent more robots to try to talk directly to the other robots, and these robots were either worshipped as God or else they were destroyed,
yeah.
Or both. Right.
Or both.
Yes. And as a matter of fact, the problem is still there. They have not yet solved that problem.
I see. In fact, we haven't, which really brings me to my next question. Those robots in the cave created a sense of them being independent of any other source, as it were. And we might liken that state as the I.
The self, yeah.
The self. So the question is, does the I really exist, or is it an illusion? If it is an illusion, how is it that we appear to be able to create or think a thought? Is the I really separate from thought?
Yes, well, to put it briefly, I'd say the I as we know it is not separate from thought. That's that the I which feels itself to be separate is thought. Now, there was an ancient view of the self, which was that I am the unknown. I'm an unknown which is constantly revealing itself, mm-hmm. which is different from the ordinary concept of the self, which is something known with identity. Mm. The self is something with identity over time and limited, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be, but also in unlimited, because you have this megalomania, this wish to make the self, it doesn't want to stay limited, right?
Yes.
Now, how could the self be thought? You see, you have to see how thought works. You see, let's come back. First of all, if you see a television program with a telephone bell in there and the bell rings, your thought immediately attributes it to the image, and you experience it coming from the image. There's nothing there in the image at all, right?
Mm-hmm.
But suppose nobody gets up to ring the bell, there's an
to answer the phone,
there's an incoherence, mm-hmm. and you wonder, where is it coming from? It may be coming from the next room. Then you see it differently, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the point is that thought can attribute to real things, to put shape and form and figure into them and make them seem what something else, right? Like if you take the rainbow, it's nothing but rain falling and light refracting off the raindrops, right? But you see a bow, there's a figure thrown onto the raindrops. Hmm. Is that clear?
Yes.
Everybody sees the same bow. That's proof. It should be your guys' proof. It must be there, right?
Right.
But it's not there.
But in fact, everyone sees a different one.
He sees his own rainbow.
Everyone sees his own rainbow.
But very similar.
Yeah.
That's what the chair is seen the same way, right?
Of course, yeah.
So there's an appearance which is not an appearance of... That bow is not a correct appearance of reality, right?
Mm-hmm. And yet there's a tacit agreement that it is...
Well, people now know that it's not there, you see, but they don't...
I didn't know.
They used to say, chase the rainbow and find
right.
a pot of gold at the end.
Of course. But in fact, I don't know that it's common knowledge that what we're all looking at is different rainbows.
Yeah.
But
at least they're not... They're all related to a chair, but in the case of the rainbow, they're not related... They're only related to the drops of rain, you see,
absolutely.
Not to a bow. Now, this is crucial because... If you can throw onto the drops of rain a bow, you could throw on any shape onto the drops of rain, and everybody might agree that that's it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, consciousness is full of all sorts of events going on, feelings, you know, little things going on here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And the thought throws onto it a shape called me.
Hmm.
You see, at a center, you may feel it to be in the solar plexus or the chest or the head.
Can we stop again? You're saying thought projects that?
Yes, as it projected the rainbow.
Oh,
if you...
Mm-hmm.
Right?
So thought creates the me rather than me creating.
Yes. But then if you don't see that happening, you will treat that as real and give it reality, apparent reality.
Mm-hmm.
If you will take the whole being will take actions on that basis which seem to be coming from the center.
Hmm.
As the telephone sound seems to be coming from the telephone, from the television image, when it couldn't possibly be doing so.
But it has to be gaining some kind of strength if it's capable of, in fact, thinking about a specific...
Well, the strength comes from your whole being. You see, there's thoughts. Remember the nature of thought is conditioned reflex.
Oh, right.
One thought leads to another,
right.
to another. You don't have to do anything.
Yeah, it's doing it for you.
Yeah.
It's doing it for you. And
yes.
The me.
Remember, thought is conditioned reflex mm-hmm. at a very high, subtle level. And mm. it just goes by itself. But it has in it the thought that thought is being produced by a center which it calls me. And mm-hmm. all the feelings which should belong to that center are thrown onto the consciousness as if from me, right?
And in fact, our society reinforces that.
Everybody says the same, like everybody sees the same rainbow, everybody sees the same self, whether it's there or not, right?
Mm-hmm. And then, in fact, we can create concepts that everyone sees, like nationalism.
Right. Yes, and in fact, later on, it becomes all important. It's regarded as central, supremely important, and all sorts of powerful feelings will arise if it's questioned.
Mm-hmm.
You see, now it all goes on by itself, and you see what there's a deeper being, I say, which can, which is that being which is may be able to reveal itself anew, rather than being a fixed being. It's deep in the implicate order in the infinite.
And that being is not an I.
Well, we don't know what it is. It's unknown. As long as all this is going on, how are you going to tell? You
of
see?
Course, of course.
I mean, it's like all the lights in the city, you can't see the universe.
Surely. I remember that when you mentioned about being in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Could you repeat that analogy?
Yes, well, that just simply in Las Vegas, there are a vast number of flashing lights, and you could never see the stars. You might imagine that there is no universe other than Las Vegas, right?
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, you might imagine that the universe we experience through the self is the universe. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it may be just thrown on like the rainbow, you see.
And in fact, within the socio-cultural patterns that we've established,
yeah.
There is that razzle-dazzle happening all the time.
Yes, noise, lights, whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
That's excitement.
Hmm. Mm. Let me just take this one step further. I'll go back to the book, The Causality and Chance in Modern Physics, because there you did mention, to my knowledge, for the first time, necessity and contingency.
Yes.
How do necessity and contingency work together to perpetuate what appears to be self-deception?
This is a crucial point that, you see, the word necessary means it cannot be otherwise, right?
Mm-hmm.
And contingency is the opposite, what can be otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Latin root of necessary is necessi, meaning don't yield.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think something is necessary, you also get a feeling of an attitude, not yielding. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's what cannot be turned aside, you see. Now, it's very important in our thought to make order of priorities of necessity so that A turns aside for B and B turns aside for C and so on.
That happens mechanically?
Well, either intelligently or mechanically. Some things are more important than others. I say this is necessary, but that is more important, so I do that.
Mm-hmm.
But that can go wrong. Mm-hmm. We can give extreme necessity to trivialities. Right?
Mm-hmm. All the time.
Yeah. So now the point to remember is necessity is not just an intellectual concept. It is a feeling. It is an urge, a drive. The will is determined by what you think is necessary.
Mm-hmm.
The more necessary you think it is, the stronger the will and the stronger the desire.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole movement is, the idea that thought is only thought is wrong. You see, all these conditioned reflexes go on together.
Mm.
Now necessity may be perceived, I'm not saying it's only a reflex.
Of course.
It can be perceived afresh, mm-hmm. but it goes on to the conditioning, mm-hmm. becomes a set of reflexes, right? Now the reflex of necessity works without your thinking. By the feeling of the urge, the will, the drive, right?
Mm.
Mm. Intense will, drive, need.
And again, those necessities, the values applied to the necessities can be arbitrary.
That's right, but they vary. Now, there's you see, that which is absolutely necessary would be supremely valuable and take priority over everything else.
Mm.
You see, if you think God is there, then you might give his will absolute necessity.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, the state may take absolute necessity, or something else, your personal ambition, the desire to expand your ego, to be megalomaniac.
Mm-hmm.
Anything, make money, anything could take absolute necessity, or even the most trivial pursuit, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What makes it absolute in our mind?
We say something is necessary. Now we start to make a conditioned reflex, saying that we did it this time, this time, this time. There's a tendency now to make it, saying it's always so.
Mm-hmm.
When it's always so, then it's a small step to say it's necessary. Mm. And if you say it's always necessary, then it's absolute.
Right.
You see, step by step, we slide into absolute necessity. Right?
Which is at the core of self-deception.
That's right, because if there's absolute necessity, it is absolutely necessary to keep on thinking that this idea is absolutely necessary, and it cannot be questioned, right?
Mm.
And therefore you have to distort and deceive yourself.
Mm. And does that seem to be prevalent at the present time?
Well, all times that we know of, it's been prevalent.
And it's always been.
You see, people have always believed what they wanted to believe, made them feel better, you know. They've always accepted that their religious beliefs are right, and Mm-hmm. Their beliefs about the state or the emperor are right.
I see.
And so about whatever they're doing, right?
Mm-hmm. And at the present time in society, nationalism, for example.
Well, nationalism, religious fanaticism, and also there's a belief that it's absolutely necessary to have economic growth, when we know that if everybody were to grow at that rate over the whole world, it would destroy the planet like a swarm of locusts. You see, we have to question that necessity.
Mm-hmm.
That may kill us, right?
Mm. Along those lines, I believe it was Archimedes who once said that, give me a place to stand and a stick long enough and I will move the world. If you were given a few moments of planetary silence, a place to stand or sit, and a megaphone large enough, what message would you convey in an attempt to move the world in the direction it must go if it is to survive?
I would say we've got to pay attention to thought and to communicate our communication, because that these absolute necessities interfere with communication, so we can't listen to each other and can't work together.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can't work together, then no idea is going to be of any use.
Mm-hmm. So we have to begin. Square one would be paying attention to thought itself
and how it keeps us apart.
I see. And that leads us to this notion of dialogue, as you define the word.
Yes, this dialogue is the Greek root dialogos. Logos means word, but meaning. Dia means through. So you can think of meaning flowing among people. And I gave the example of an anthropologist I read many years ago, studied a North American Indian tribe, the hunter-gatherers, and they would sit in a circle and just talk and talk about and gender without decisions or without authority or without anything, and then they would end up, it seemed, with no conclusion, and they would all know what to do, because
mm-hmm.
they kept on talking. They didn't just talk once, they would talk regularly, right?
Right.
Now, if we were able to do that, we would see, the main problem is that people are not able to listen and talk with each other, and therefore how can they get together?
Do you feel that at the present situation, the specific situation, that people are listening to each other with regard to the international situation?
Well, not very much, no.
Not very much. Which leads me to what I call my bonus question. It pertains specifically to the events of today as they're happening as we get together. On a recent program on CNN, journalist Robert Novak was interviewing Dr. Gerald Post, professor of psychiatry and political psychology at George Washington University in the United States. For more than 20 years, Dr. Post prepared psychological profiles of world leaders for presidents and senior United States officials. Now, here's the first question Mr. Novak asked. This is the question. Dr. Post, put simply, is Saddam Hussein a megalomaniac, a madman, or a rational seeker of power? Dr. Post answered this way. He is certainly not a madman. He is very much a rational seeker of power. He has, however, many personality features which make him an extremely dangerous man. Try as I might, I find no evidence of conscience in him. His ambitions are boundless for power. First, the question that Mr. Novak asked. Is there such a thing as a rational seeker of power?
Yes, well, I would ask, why should anybody seek power? You see, that's is there a good reason? You see, is there a valid reason? Mm-hmm. I mean, what does he want it for? There have been many, at least I heard there have been 12, 15 attempts to assassinate him. Eventually, one is likely to succeed. Seekers of power often get assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
They suffer a great deal and so on. Why do they do it? Now, there must be something. You see, I think that the world confuses people from early childhood. You see, it was Alexander the Great, and he apparently had a very bad relation to his father, and his mother hated his father, and he was probably identified with his mother, and he probably felt he had to show his father something.
Boy.
And he gave him the energy to conquer the world, a tremendous energy with he commanded absolute devotion from his troops and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's a much higher level than Saddam, obviously, but
But could that action be considered rational?
No, because I think I must ask why he did it.
Oh, I see. There was an irrationality because of the
yes, and saying what there's some incoherence in this whole thing. Why do you need power, you see? What for? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you ask why, because there's a thought in you of absolute necessity of power. Huh. And that what gave you that thought? I mean, probably some experience that you were powerless.
Could it be society itself?
Society constantly tells people they're no good, they're worthless, you're nothing, you're just a little you, and you ought to be more, and so on, right? And also particular cases like troubles with fathers, mothers, teachers, you know, friends.
So society embellishes the notion that power is, in fact, something to strive for. And
well, at least it creates in the person the feeling that he's powerless and that if he had power, he would be all right. Mm-hmm. It creates a very disturbing feeling of being powerless.
Mm-hmm.
You see, now when people feel powerless, they say, I need power. But I say, I think they need it like they need a hole in the head. What they've got to do is find out why do they feel powerless.
So it comes from their powerlessness that they feel that they need power.
Yeah, that is the belief in the absolute truth that they are powerless. You see, they are totally convinced they're powerless, right?
Mm. Which is why they strive for power.
Yes, that's why they don't have any power, because they're convinced they haven't got any, right?
And which, in fact, can never be...
They're never satisfied, because, you see, that it's always on the conditioned record as a reflex that I need power. I may get as much power as you could imagine, but I still... Like Alexander the Great said just before, when he was right at the top, he said he was feeling sad because he had no more worlds to conquer.
It's tough. Well, Professor Bohm, I want to thank you very much, really. I appreciate the time you've taken to be with us today. And, hopefully we'll do it again.
I hope so, yeah. You think we got it all?
I think so.